Well, good morning, Glenn Andreessen, here beside you now until noon. Welcome to the Dirtbag, and also welcome to Chip Buble, back from, I don't know, it's been a couple of years maybe since you've been on.
I think so, something like that, yeah.
Chip,
glad to be here.
Great. Chip has a vast knowledge of anything. He said before we went on the air, ask me anything. Okay, now what do you think about the president's... No, and not only am I going to ask him anything, but you can too. This is a good chance to get your garden questions answered. Give us a call, 503-231-8187. Jim Gilbert, my normal guest co-host, is away at a pawpaw festival someplace in Kentucky or...
Would have to be.
Wherever that is.
Pawpaw
there.
Central, I think, out
yeah.
there.
And he'll have tales to tell next month about that. Our plant of the month today is garlic. Chip knows garlic. And we will also be talking a lot about tomatoes. I had some pre-show conversation with that and all sorts of stuff that we can talk about. But you also, once again, can direct the conversation here by your calls, 503-231-8187. I've got one event to mention. Chip, maybe you have some that you want to talk about. Chip is the OSU Agricultural Extension Agent in Columbia County.
Correct.
And has been for...
30-plus years.
What's going to happen when you retire? Who knows?
Who knows?
They're going to be at a loss.
Hopefully they'll fill it with another individual that cares about doing this stuff.
Oh, great. Well, the one event that I'll pass along is the All About Fruit Show, which is happening mid-October. And this is at the Clackamas County Fairgrounds and in Canby. Back to Canby. It's been Washington County Fairgrounds. I really would like to see that in Portland sometime. But I think the problem is they can't find a space that they can afford and that has enough space. Because they need a lot of space to spread out all the fruit that they have. The All About Fruit Show, the Home Orchard Society, it's October 15th and 16th, and there is a slight admission charge for that unless you join the Home Orchard Society, and then it's free. But this is a chance for you to taste, well, we think it's the largest fruit tasting in the United States. Now, many years we have, I say we because I'm a member, 800 varieties of fruits and nuts and all sorts of things we can't taste them all, but you can look at a lot of them, but... One year we had 400 varieties of pears alone, and several hundred of apples, and then grapes, and maybe pawpaws, and hardy kiwi, regular kiwi, and you can also order up trees at that point to be made, grafted by the Home Orchard Society. So that is October 15th, 16th, the weekend, and hopefully we'll have a representative on next month, because we'll have a Dirtbag show before then.
Yeah, and actually one thing that I think they still do at the All About Fruit show is they have a table of expert fruit identifiers.
That's right.
And that's actually a pretty important service, because a lot of people have trees in their landscape, either they purchased and forgot what they were, or they're purchasing a house or with a planted landscape, mm-hmm. and planted fruit trees and have no idea what they are, or an old homestead that may have stuff that goes back 150 or 125 years. And I send an awful lot of people from my county to the All About Fruit Show simply to get something identified. But the key is you have to pick the fruit now and keep it in halfway good condition, or pick it when it's ripe and keep it in halfway good condition before you take it down there. But I think it's a great service that the Home Orchard Society does at that fruit show. I think it's pretty important, actually.
And you were telling me, once again, pre-show, that you've had some unusual fruit that's been brought into your office.
I just a little while ago had a very attractive, very small, or small European-style pear. It was fully ripe, it was fully crisp, fully sweet, bright pink on the inside, and an incredible cinnamon overtone. And so...
Doesn't that make me... You want to plant one of those? Boy, that sounds good.
Yeah, it was good. And so anyway, we're going to try to find out what that is.
At the
Home Orchard Show.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, these old guys, and there's even some young guys that are getting good at identifying it. So that's a good event. All right, we have the plant of the month. Like I said, that will be right next here at Garlic. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll have the answer to the Garden Stumper quiz from last month and a new Garden Stumper quiz. Yes, indeed. Chip doesn't know about this part of the program, but we'll answer both questions. So, garlic. Tis the season, or almost, maybe,
almost
anyway.
Almost the season, yeah. Basically, any time from, you know, mid-September through mid to late October is a great time to plant garlic. And there's several ways of getting planting stock. You can go to a farmer's market and find some garlic that looks great and in good condition. And they'll tell you, hopefully the grower will tell you the name of the garlic, and you can take it home and plant it. And the bigger the clove you plant, in, you know, you separate the cloves in the bulb, and the bigger the clove you plant, the bigger the bulb you'll ultimately get next year. So sometimes you don't plant the little cloves in the center, and you plant it in a place that's going to be sunny next spring and summer and through the winter, if you can, not as much sun as we can get, and reasonably well-drained. And if it's not well-drained, put it up in a raised bed. And it's not a bad idea to lime the soil beforehand, before you plant, if you haven't limed it in a while. And then plant it, you know, an inch and a half, 2 inches deep. Cover it with a little bit of mulch so the ground doesn't crust on you. And just keep weeding between now and February, and maybe fertilize it again with a, if you want to use an organic material, would be something like a blood meal or some of those kinds of things. And then maybe do it once again in May or not, depending on what the you know, kind of the nitrogen and mineral content of your soils are. And then harvest it in mid-July. It's really pretty much a no-brainer. It's a great thing to plant.
You mentioned going to a farmer's market. Is mm-hmm. there some danger of planting one from a supermarket?
Probably not.
I mean, I know
there's fewer varieties available in the supermarket.
Oh, okay.
And the reason for this, there's a big division in garlics between the so-called hardnecks and softnecks. Most of the hardneck varieties, to really get the size bulb you want, have to be, the floral stalk needs to be broken off as it's coming up in the springtime, and or in the late spring, early summer, to get the really, to send that energy into the bulb. A large commercial grower, which is what's going to show up at the supermarkets, mm-hmm. aren't going to have the time to do that. And the softneck varieties, which don't make a floral stalk, will produce a better bulb, or bigger bulb, if you will, for the amount of square, you know.
Well, let's...
Does that make any sense?
Well, let's explain what the difference is between a hard neck and a soft neck.
Okay, well, the hard neck is if there had been a floral stalk that came up from that garlic. And now, not all garlics will do that.
Okay, now I grow what my neighbor called 20 years ago serpentine garlic.
Right.
That's the floral stalk
it
that sends up.
The floral stalk comes up and circles around.
Yeah, like a little piglet tail
or
something.
Right, and actually when it matures, it doesn't make seed because garlic does not make true seed. It makes these little bulbils or bulblets that are genetically identical to what you planted and can actually be planted either like green onions for fresh green garlic, or given 2 years can actually make a regular garlic. But if our listeners are interested, I could talk a little bit more about that later. But you will get a slightly bigger bulb if you take that floral stalk off before it grows all the way up.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so and, you will, depending on variety, it'll increase in size between 15% and 30%.
Well, that's sizable, really.
Yeah, significant, yeah.
So, once again, though, the difference between a hard neck and a soft neck.
The soft necks do not produce a floral stalk.
Okay,
Just don't.
And how would you know that when you're purchasing
You can feel the garlic itself, and the hard necks it'll be cut off, but that stem will be there. You'll be able to feel that round stem. It'll still be there. And even if they took it off early to increase the size a little bit, that hard stem going down will still be there. Whereas the soft necks, there's nothing. The soft necks are typically the ones that are used for braiding because it's hard to braid with that stem sticking there.
And so, is there any difference as far as storage of this hard neck, soft neck?
You know, people have said one stores better than the other. I think it's variety by variety, and it's less dependent on whether it's hard neck or soft neck. That's my view years.
So to review here, you go to the farmer's market and you just get whatever.
You get some stuff that looks good, maybe buy three or four different types, taste them, and plant some of them.
And some are reddish in tone, so that might be a nice.
Yeah, there's all sorts of different types, and there's definitely different flavors in the garlic that I'm sure you've experienced if you grow more than one. And there's definitely some very different flavor profiles.
So my take-home message from this is cut off the hard neck before when? You know, when it's four inches tall? When
usually it comes up sometime mid to late May. It emerges out of the center of the leaves that are uh-huh. already present there in the garlic after you've planted it in the fall. By spring, it's there. And so it's going to come up mid-May to late May. Early June this year, it was actually delayed a little mm-hmm. bit this year by the year. And when you can see the little floral cluster at the top of the stalk, that's when you want to cut it off before it's really fully formed.
Oh, yeah. But you want to go that long?
You want to see it a little bit, because apparently sometimes, and I've not really seen this much, but I've heard some growers say that if you cut it off too soon, it will form another little floral stalk, and then you've wasted
okay.
your time.
Okay, so you wouldn't want to cut it off when it's 4 or 5 inches.
Well, it depends on whether it's showing that little...
Okay.
Okay, if it's showing that little flower already, you can cut it.
Yeah. All right.
And actually, some people will eat those floral stalks like asparagus. They're very tender, slight garlic overtone, and they're quite good, actually. And there has been a market in the floral industry for some of those really serpentine ones
uh-huh.
that are actually quite spectacular just before they open up to go all the way through the bulbil stage or bulblet stage.
See, I told you he knows garlic. Okay, we have a call. Sam, good morning. You're with the Dirtbag.
Good morning, Dirtbag.
Yeah, it sounds kind of funny, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm used to it, though.
Great title. Hey, I got a question. I got a problem. I have one pear tree on the place. It's an old heirloom. It's probably a Bartlett. But this year, there's a black scab on the leaves. It looks like a pustule, but on closer examination, it's flat.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe raised on the backside of the leaf, and... I think it's been there all along, just like a light infection, and now it's probably taken the whole tree and maybe affecting the fruit.
Go ahead, Chip.
Okay, well, my quick response, Sam, is that it's probably pear scab, which is a fungus disease that's very similar to apple scab.
Right.
And the disease is a disease of the... moist weather we had in April and May. By June this year, pretty much we dried out, but infections that took place in April and May would still remain on the leaves. Some of the newer leaves wouldn't have it, but all the leaves that were exposed at that period of time.
And the fruit.
And the fruit, right, can get it too. And so as wet as it was in May, it's an awfully difficult disease to control. Usually it won't kill the tree. Some of the things, though, that you could do to help manage it next year, anything you can do to improve air circulation always helps. So whether it's pruning or looking around to see if there's something you can remove to improve the air circulation is a good thing. Raking up the leaves and getting rid of them as they fall, because that is a source of inoculum for the next year. And so that can be really important. And then the third thing is that if you were growing them organically, a product called lime sulfur, calcium polysulfide, has been used for years as a scab control, and it doesn't work to eliminate the disease once on a portion of the leaf once it's going. It's just to protect the portions that haven't become infected yet. But if there were gaps in the rain and you felt like you wanted to spray, but usually on the pears, unless the infection is really bad, it won't. It's kind of a surface thing and won't really affect the eating quality. But if it's really bad, it will distort the fruit and make it less, you know, vigorous. So I don't know. Does that make any sense to you? Or
yes, it does. Because it's just this year that it was so bad, I thought maybe I was going to lose the tree or have to take it out.
No, I think not. And actually, I suspect you had some last year, because last year was worse than this year in terms of rain. We got rain all the way through the end of June in 2010. And so we actually getting out of it in June 1st this year was helped improve the prospects. But still, there could have been a huge inoculum load from 2010 starting to build up.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Good. Yeah, just one thing about pears, you know, those Bartletts, it's probably past time to be harvesting those Bartletts for their peak.
Yeah.
We talked about this it was in July, that... you know, most pears need to be harvested when they're unripe.
Right.
And then allowed to ripen off the tree.
Right. And barlets are a good one because they don't have to go through a cold storage.
Right.
And that's why from a home garden standpoint, and especially a canning standpoint, they've been kind of a standard for us. But they don't, as you say, they don't store a long time.
Right.
You know, but they're a great variety, and yeah, we're getting close to the end on the Bartlett's.
I'm speaking with Chip Bubel, who's the Columbia County OSU Extension agricultural agent. Let's go take another call. Good morning, Pam. You're with the Dirtbag.
Good morning, Dirtbag, and also your guest.
Chip.
My question is more for you, and it's quite similar to the last question, but a little bit different in that if one wants to spray one's trees, not with a poison, but with perhaps a sulfur compound, which may be poison, we have bees. And my neighbor sprayed his trees, and he offered to, you know, loan it, you know, let us use his spray. And I didn't because I was afraid that it would harm our bees in the springtime because the instructions said to, I believe it was spray now, whenever that time of the year was, and then later, right when the buds were either forming or, these are fruit trees, either forming or beginning to bloom. And I forget exactly which, but I thought that might be harmful to the bees. Could you please let me know, you know, something about this when you have backyard bees, what you should do?
Yeah, and this is which spray were you...
Can I answer off there?
One question, or two questions. Okay. What spray were you thinking of, lime sulfur or
I think it
copper?
Was a lime sulfur.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think most of the time the recommendations on lime sulfur are to not spray during open bloom. So it's either a dormant spray, and that's kind of a more concentrated rate, or after bloom is over at a more reduced rate. And so usually you're avoiding the bees. But I actually don't think that the sulfur would... I mean, it might. I guess it's a little, maybe
right.
a little caustic, but it's not a hugely toxic thing to bees, I don't believe.
Well, and one of the things that we're learning about the bees, or at least the reaction, is that while some of these fungicides may not directly kill the bee, they may kill the bacteria mostly, and may, well, you know, it's a fungicide, so it, I don't know how it would affect the bacteria. But there are. These bacteria and fungus in the guts of the bees that they use, they regurgitate them and they add them to the pollen that's being stored inside the colony to ferment it.
Okay.
And one of the things that does is it breaks down, well, it preserves it. You know, we use these bacteria to make yogurt
sure.
and kombucha and sauerkraut and things like that. So they do the same thing to do that. But it also breaks the pollen cell walls down so that they can actually get inside and use the nutrients of that. So there could be that residual part, but I have not read anything that points a finger at these lime sulfur.
Right. And typically the bees wouldn't be attracted to the tree once it was not in bloom.
Right. That's true.
Yeah.
And it's unlikely that I mean, if you're spraying, you could, and you have backyard bees, you certainly wouldn't want to aim the spray so there's any kind of drift or something like that towards the colony itself.
Towards the hive, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, you'd always be careful.
Or your house,
or, yeah.
for that matter, because for one, it stains,
but
I'm sulfur. So I hope that helped Pamela with her question there on backyard bees. We don't get too many questions on bees, but we will.
Good. What are the rules in Portland about beekeeping?
Well, it's legal.
Mm-hmm.
You should get a permit, and that means requiring, or the requirement is that you get signatures from your neighbors within 150 feet of your property line.
Okay.
Although these rules are in flux, and they are probably will be changed somewhat, maybe lessening the 150 feet.
Yeah.
It seems a little onerous for some.
Mm-hmm.
And... Okay, well, that's it.
Okay.
I guess that answers your question. It's not like chickens in the city where you can have three chickens without a permit.
Right.
It's with any bees.
Right.
You need that permit.
Okay.
Okay, let's... Gordon, you're with the Dirtbag. Thanks for calling.
Hello?
Oh, well, this doesn't sound like Gordon, but I you never know these days. Telly.
Oh, no. I have a couple questions. One about... My husband has a melon patch in a community garden, and we just found out that someone had planted potatoes last year, and so there's some either verticillium wilt or fusarium wilt. Is there anything? Because they're fruiting, but is there anything I can spray that would be somewhat effective?
Just Chip. Basically not. Those are soil-borne fungi. But you're saying they had potatoes in last year, and the plants are growing and fruiting.
They're growing and fruiting, but the vines are wilting big time.
Pardon me for interrupting. Are you talking about the potatoes or the melons?
No, muskmelon.
Yeah.
Specifically
Noonan
star.
Yeah. It could be verticillium or fusarium wilt. There are some varieties that have resistance to both fungi. But you'd have to look for that on the description of the seed for that. But there's really no way to, we have no fumigants that will effectively do anything in the soil. So just a rotation over time and kind of hope for a dissipation over time and planting to things that are not susceptible to, if for sure it's verticillium or fusarium, there are some other wilt diseases. There's a bacterial wilt that the cucumber beetle moves around that occasionally causes problems. I haven't seen it a lot, but I do see it. And then right now, powdery mildew can be affecting all the, cucurbits
a lot. Yeah, it's not powdery mildew because my zucchini has that.
Okay. Yeah, the problem with, actually doing a real diagnosis of it is that we'd have to send it in to the plant path lab at OSU, and that's a $50 charge. And so they can isolate the fungus, if what's causing the problem. But I would say look for some verticillium or fusarium resistant lines that you'd like to plant and or rotate to non susceptible crops over a period of time.
Yeah, well, it's interesting though, because for people who don't have the same plot year after year, it's almost you're getting an STD from the community garden.
Yeah.
You didn't even know what was there.
Well,
but I had one other question too. Do you think that putting black plastic around tomatoes or peppers would make much difference to accelerate?
Or red plastic.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what.
Right.
Yeah.
Would it make a difference with this weather dipping so low? I mean.
Oh, right now?
Yeah.
Oh, this. I would say if you have a lot of time on your hands, but the soil is pretty warm now.
Pretty warm, yeah. Now, if you're trying to maintain soil temperatures, actually clear plastic maintains it better than black plastic because it's almost like it's a greenhouse effect where the sun goes through it, warms the soil directly. The problem is you get weed growth. You stimulate weeds too under the clear plastic, but right now your tomatoes are pretty competitive, I'm guessing, and plus the plastic will suppress it if you hold it down fairly tight. But
I might wait several weeks too. I mean, you get 90 degree days, and that's pretty too warm under
too
there.
Too warm, perhaps.
I mean, it seems to a nugget of information that I have stuck in my brain is that the tomato plant will start dropping blossoms at 95 or something like that?
Yeah. We had quite a few different plants that in that weather we had last week would lose florals, would lose blossoms, just drop automatically when the temperature, green beans are classic, peppers will do it a little bit, some varieties more than others, some tomato varieties more than others will drop blooms at certain temperatures. So, yeah.
I mean, and this is in the 90 or 80 to 90 degree range,
usually
or 85 to 90.
Usually it's 90 plus.
90 plus, yeah. Well, we had it.
I didn't have too much problem with that, but like just now that, they're like just turning and just like frozen and, I don't know.
Just not getting red as fast as you.
Yeah.
Your heart's desire.
I think they will. I mean, we're mid-September here, and we've got good 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah, I've been having a lot of discussions with that with my clients in Columbia County. And there's, everyone remembers the tomato blight that attacked last year in early September. And so they're sitting there on pins and needles watching. They've all had red fruit. I think everybody has picked up some red tomatoes at this point.
Right.
But you see so much there that you would like to have. And I think I agree with Glenn. I think the weather forecasts are reasonably positive. And so I would not not panic at this point. Yeah. I mean, obviously we have less day length than we did earlier.
What about stressing the plant to ripen?
Yeah, I'm not completely sure I'm comfortable with that. There's a disorder called blossom end rot which I think is aggravated by stressing the plants. So it's a complicated story about calcium and water movement and all sorts of things. But nevertheless, I guess I'm more a believer in maybe doing some pruning of a few shoots and things like that. But other than that, just stay the course.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. We have another 2 months. You know, we were talking once again. You know, we can have tomato production up until mid-November.
Yeah.
If the weather.
You know, it really is so dependent, I think, for us on the rains and the blossom end rot, or not the blossom, the late blight. It's usually not cold temperatures here in the Portland metro area that stops us. Up through, it may slow us, but it doesn't stop us up through about mid-October. It's the rain. That's usually what does our tomatoes in.
Okay, it's time for the answer to last month's Garden Stumper quiz. The Port of Portland is the nation's number one exporter of what? Okay, the answer to that is wheat. That's pretty good. Nations. Okay, and this is a two-parter now, once again, kind of commodities here. What is the commodity that is that Bandon is known for, and what is the crop that Brookings is known for, both there on the southern Oregon coast? So if you know the question, or if you know the answer to those questions, give us a call, 503-231-8187, and let's get back to the phones. Gordon, you're back.
Hi, how are you? How are you?
Good, very good. Thanks for calling.
I got dropped out earlier. So I got a couple questions. Last time we talked, I covered up my garden with black plastic. You remember that conversation we had?
Yeah, this was in the spring, getting ready for...
That was fall.
Fall.
Winter.
All right.
That was winter, actually. I was right about Christmas time, right around in there. But so I took the plastic off. We did a bunch of sheet mulching. We did the double digging of the 9,000 feet of the oak leaves and stuff. It was great. So what I'm experiencing now is hundreds of pounds worth of tomatoes. I'm not kidding you. I've harvested about 200 pounds of tomatoes with no irrigation, no watering whatsoever this year. They haven't been watered since the last rains, May, June. Absolutely amazing. Working with the guilds of the tomatoes is amazing. I won the Cully Neighborhood Market for the most tastiest, long-lasting tomato. But above and beyond that, what's happening is all my carrots that were growing with the tomatoes, they seem, number one, this is the first question, the carrots seem to have, like, went down into the ground and ran into a wall, and then they all split, and they were really juicy sugar, but they were all deformed and Frankensteined. What happened to those carrots?
One cause of splits are just sudden bursts of water, but if we haven't had any water since, kind of the end of May, I'm not sure whether that would be it. The other is sort of episodic growth will cause, splits and like, arms and legs on carrots and stuff like that. Those are two things that I know. A little bit sometimes a lot of nitrogen can cause some of those things too, but I don't know whether that would be part of the equation here or not. So I don't know for sure.
I did water with the compost tea right before I went to the Rainbow Gathering June 24th, and I found that a lot of my carrots, I had triple legs and all kinds of stuff. So they just weren't very appealing. They weren't very large, but they had large flavors. So that was the one thing. Maybe they ran into some clumps, because I understand you have to have real sandy loam for the carrots.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think, the better the tilth of the soil, the straighter the carrot historically, too. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that play into this.
Was this new ground that the carrots were in?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. And even though you double dug, I'm sure the soil was a bit heavy.
Oh, it was still clumpy and heavy, for sure.
Okay.
Second question, the chard. I have been getting killed by these little things that live
leaf miners
in the leaves. What are those, and how do I kill those off?
What you have are leaf miner, or the leaf miner larvae, that a fly, I think, that lays the egg on the underneath side of the chard and spinach.
And kale.
It, Kale?
Yeah.
No, you probably have something else. Well, we'll see. But the egg hatches into a larva. It kind of tunnels in and it starts eating inside the leaves. It mines the insides of the leaves
chlorophyll.
There.
The chlorophyll.
Well, it's getting everything, and then it will eventually pupate into an adult. But they're hard to control by you.
Right.
But it's easier to when you let nature do the controlling there. And what I do is allow the wasps to harvest those. Yellow jackets, mud daubers, paper wasps, the larger wasps, not the mini wasps, the predatory wasps. And you can see the eggs on the underneath side. If you have few plants, you can just go around every so often and just rub those out. But what I do is, I let some of the miners go, or the leaves go with the miners inside them. That they will attract the wasps. And even though the outer leaves look pretty bad, and visitors to my garden, or when I give addresses at talks at garden clubs, they'll say, "Oh, I'd never leave those outer leaves there," you know. But I leave those to attract the beneficial insects, these wasps.
Right.
And if you go to my garden at any time, and well, any time when it's light, and look at these patches, you will see yellow jackets and wasps tirelessly looking under these leaves for those miners. So that's a good natural.
In the meantime, they destroy most of your CSA leaf that you need to put into your shares.
That's right. I mean, but I'm willing to do that for me. But Chip will have the other answers.
Yeah, I guess in a commercial setting, the two answers that I think commercial organic growers, for example, are doing. One is, if you get row covers up quickly enough, they are a physical barrier. And so there are the very light, like half-ounce row covers that are really designed to be insect barriers with a little bit of heat retention. And they have been used successfully by growers. The other option is to look for an organic insecticide that will help you. And probably the one that has become most useful in this regard the active ingredient is called spinosad, and so it is being sold in the organic world as Entrust, and so
that's a bacteria, is it?
It's a fungal fermentation. It's a product of a fungal fermentation. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. My other question is: all my melons, all my squashes, and all my pumpkins and stuff—they're all like. I'm not going to even have any pumpkins and squashes and stuff for Halloween because they're already done blooming. And my plants are, like, all dying. One minute they had no powdery mildew, and the next minute they were just laden with powdery mildew. And now I go out there, and the plants are just decrepit, and they're just, like, dying, and all my melons are, like, already all orange. And so I'm wondering, will they continue to get larger as the plant keeps continuously dying, or is it done deal?
Powdery mildew, it can be pretty devastating. If it's taken away most of the leaf area and you're not getting any new leaves that are really going to be productive, then you're probably close to done. Powdery mildew is an interesting one. It's one of the few fungi that likes dry weather. It likes dry weather but high humidity. And we've had some days that have been that in spades in the last 2 or 3 weeks where we've had sort of elevated temperatures, but, you know, 60, 70, 80% humidity. And that's kind of a powdery mildew event waiting to happen. And so, you know, we'll always see powdery mildew to some degree. It's part of our summers on many of these things. Again, look for some, you know, powdery mildew resistance that is available in the squash family in some lines. So try to look for lines that give you some, at least, it may slow it down some.
Okay, now what I should do is dig in now and get it all prepared. And what should I plant for winter in those crops, in those rows that have the old squash and pumpkin?
Well, any cover crop would be fine there.
What about producing food?
Well, there are two that I grow for cover crops. One is cilantro, and you can seed that anytime. And the other is spinach.
Okay.
And while those aren't legumes, so they don't enrich the soil with nitrogen. I mean, they do keep the biological activity going somewhat in the soil. And the spinach will germinate now that it's a little bit cooler. That would be good. Or maybe I'd wait a week or two before you seed that. And I just broadcast seed. I save my spinach seed, so I have lots of it to do. Broadcast, and it'll grow. I mean, it'll germinate and grow to one, two, 3 inches, and it'll survive pretty cold temperatures. If it gets down below 20, you might lose some, but you won't lose it all. They're pretty tough. And then come March, boy, you've got some nice spinach there that can be harvested.
My last thought was maybe I should let the land sit with a cover crop or with another composting mulch and stuff over the top because it was the first year, or should I?
No. You want to keep the biological activity going in the soil there.
Okay, so don't let it sit and rest.
No.
Okay.
One thought that I had, thanks, Gordon, for those calls or questions. For the powdery mildew, how long does those spores need to germinate? Do they need a dry leaf surface? I mean, what if you went out there and just turned on a mister every 12 hours for 30 seconds?
Yeah, actually, the mister would be not good. Interestingly, a heavy water on the leaves, they don't like that.
Yeah.
And so there are some people that have tried to go out and sprinkled. Used a sprinkler in a high potential time, and I don't know how successful that is. Powdery mildew does seem, if it's a susceptible variety, it seems like if the conditions are generally right, it's gonna move, I think.
Yeah, squash are looking good still. Not growing pumpkins to speak of, but okay, we still have more callers. Pam, you're with the Dirt Bag. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my first garden this year. I bought a house with a bunch of raised beds, and I decided I wanted to grow popcorn. So I've grown a lot of popcorn. It's done really well, but now it's like harvest time, and I don't know how to tell when it's ready and what to do with it after.
Oh, don't worry. The squirrels will let you know when it's ready, or at least they would in my garden.
Boy, that's a good question. Oftentimes, the kernels, because popcorn is sort of a type of field corn versus sweet corn, and I think the kernels, if I'm not mistaken, will start to slightly separate a little bit on it as it matures. I think you can let it go a long time. What you don't want to let it do is start to mold. But I think you can let it go for as long as it's dry,
at least. I think the stalks will actually start drying up a little bit, won't they?
I think so.
I wondered about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I would go online and see what they say online, because I'm not sure that that's a perfect answer. I've never grown popcorn myself. Glenn, have you?
No.
Okay. So, but it seems to me some years back I answered a question for somebody in my office about that, and I think that was kind of the thing. Let it go as long as you can. You lose nothing by doing it. Just don't let it start getting really wet, because you'll get these fungi in there that are not pretty and can leave bad residues.
And even though we joked about it, the squirrels can be an issue.
Yeah.
So getting really wet just means when the rain starts.
Yeah, once the rain starts, right. Once the rain starts, that's what you don't want. Because there are a couple of semi-fungal type things that leave these residues called aflatoxins, and that's one of the big problems on the field corn they grow in the Midwest. If they have really wet weather and harvest, then they have this fungal infected stuff with a compound these things produce that's harmful to both livestock and humans. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And then do you know, once I do pick it, do I just let it dry somewhere and shell it? Do you have any idea? Or maybe I need to go online for that.
Well, you would definitely take it off the husk and let it dry. I think you could dry it on the husk potentially, bring it in and dry it on the husk.
I think you would almost have to.
But again, you want to watch that it doesn't mold inside. So you'd pull all the on the stem of the corn. You'd pull all the husks off so that it was fully air drying, I think, and then just let it dry as reasonably efficiently as you can, I think.
Okay, so other than the rain coming and the squirrels coming, my leaving it out there to just keep going while it's still not raining, I'm not going to do it any harm.
I don't think you would do it any harm. Again, I would pull an ear periodically and just take a look at it and bring it in and dry it and see what happens. See if you can pop it.
Well, you're past this danger, but there is a real potential problem, and that's cross-pollination. Back when it's hassling and whatnot, because it's very susceptible to others if cross pollination from another variety of corn that might be in your neighborhood.
Ah, okay.
And then you get a cross of Golden Jubilee and popcorn and
that
wouldn't pop at all.
That can happen for sure with corn. Although, yeah, it just depends. You know, it depends on what people are growing. If they're growing the super sweets, those don't, you know, or those mm-hmm. don't tend to do that as much. But many of the varieties, if they require isolation, can affect things. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You bet. Kurt, do we have any? Yeah. Andrew. Okay. Let's see what we got for the garden stumper question. Answer. Oh, what do you got there, Andrew?
Oh, hello. This is Andrew and Elaine. We were thinking that Brookings is probably cranberries, and I want to say wasabi for Bandon.
Well, you're right, but you're wrong. Bandon is known for cranberries. In fact, they have a cranberry festival there in Bandon. Mm. So that's right. And they grow lots there, and I can't remember now what the thing is, but is it virtually all, Chip, maybe you know?
Yeah, I think virtually all the cranberries grown in Oregon are in the Bandon area, in that region right there, yeah.
And maybe, you know, as far as the nation goes, you know, there's a lot of cranberry bogs in the north, yeah, and mid New England states and whatnot, but the red, that's a different variety that I understand. So the West Coast is in Oregon and Washington. Is known for these red berries. So a lot of the cranberries that you eat fresh come from mm-hmm. Oregon. Right. So we're very good. Half right. But so we still need the answer to the question, what is Brookings known for? Okay. Thanks for calling, Andrew. Okay. The answer to the, or the question is, what is the Brookings known for? What crop? Steve, you have an answer for us. What is it?
I don't know. I've only been there once, but I know they grow a lot of lilies.
That's right. Easter lilies, particularly.
Yeah.
Very good.
And can I ask you a question?
You betcha.
I live near an old cherry tree. It's one of the original crops that made the Bing variety.
Hmm. Do you live in Southeast Portland?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, because they're talking about cutting it down, if it's so old, I don't know if a graft of that would be of value to anyone other than nostalgia or what.
Well, it depends what variety it is. If it was one of the parents of it, then apparently they didn't think it was good enough, so they crossed it with something else to get the Bing. So I don't know, but I'll pass that along to people at the Home Orchard Society.
Is there someone there I could contact?
Yeah, why don't you could go to their website, the homeorchardsociety.org, and you could talk to or send an email to any of the officers there, president, vice president, or go on to their chat line.
Once they made the cross, they probably even have newer ones, so old one. I don't know very much about those things.
Have you eaten that cherry?
The tree's still alive. It doesn't look like it's producing anymore, so yeah. I don't know if it would be worthwhile.
That's if the cherry's a good cherry, then it's certainly easy to graft. But if it's just a so-so cherry, might as well go on.
Okay. Well, I thank you for that information, and I'll look into it further before they cut it down.
That's good.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, Chip, you have just a lot of knowledge here on why Brookings happens to grow. I think it's 90% of the nation's Easter lilies,
yeah.
90%.
Yeah, and they grow the bulbs. They don't do the forcing, and therein lies the story. And it's actually from basically a little north of Brookings down across the border into Del Norte County, California, maybe 15, 20 miles. So there's this little band along the Pacific Ocean there, Oregon and California, that they grow 90 to 95% of the Easter lily bulbs. And the thing is that these bulbs are taken shipped to the East Coast, to the Northeast, to the Southeast, all over the place to be forced for Easter lilies. And, you know, Easter changes in terms of date every year. And so the forcer, the greenhouse grower that's going to force these Easter lilies, has to absolutely know how they will grow and that they will be at the bloom stage in time for the sales that the florist or the nursery grower wants. And so we can grow Easter lily bulbs in the Willamette Valley. We can grow them in other parts of the country. But the only ones that have a really predictable forcing schedule that works anywhere in the country are the ones that come from this location in Brookings and Del Norte County, California. So it has really cemented a market for them that because it's such a reliable performing crop, when they get into the hands of the forcers, they're thrilled and no one else can take that market.
Why do you think that they're so predictable?
Bulbs are funny. Bulbs are really funny. I mean, I can tell you strange stories about garlic bulbs and all sorts of bulbs. There are timing things that are affected by the conditions that they're growing in the year before, all sorts of things that affect when they emerge as in terms of the leaves and then when the floral structures emerge and those kinds of things. So it's just that they are.
Are they grown outside or under glass?
They're grown outside. Grown outside. Down. Yeah, they're grown on bays, much like you would grow garlic, commercially. Grown on beds and...
Well, we know that during the winter, we're suffering through 32-degree weather here in Brookings. We'll pop up a 75 or something.
I know. It's a little mild banana belt, although they get quite a bit of rain. I mean, they're a fair amount of rainfall, 60 to 70 inches there, I think.
All right. Good for bulbs, though.
Yes. Good for those bulbs in particular.
All right, Kurt, what do we have? Oh, that's it. Okay, well, we have just time to talk a little bit more about cover crops here because now is the time to be really thinking about this. And I touched on this months ago. But when things start coming out of the garden, as one of our callers mentioned today, heck, get some cover crop in there. I always remember, maybe it's appropriate, that James DePriest, the former maestro of the Oregon Symphony, who had a kidney transplant, and he said, after he got his new kidney, a busy kidney is a happy kidney. In other words, you want to run a lot of water through that and just, keep it working because that's the best, that just works best that way. Well, the analogy is that's what I want to see in our soil, too. Mm-hmm. Keep that life going there. And that's one of the benefits of a cover crop is that it keeps that, as we mentioned earlier, that biological activity going. So,
I've got a question for you, Glenn. You've grown buckwheat as a cover crop before or not?
Yeah.
Somebody called me up the other day and they had the cover crop. It was just starting to flower, so there were no seeds set yet, and they were tilling it in, and they wanted to know whether they could plant immediately in terms of tilling it in. And what would you say to that?
I would say yes.
Okay, that's what I said.
I don't think that there's enough, any type of amount of foliage or material that's going to be composting in there.
Buckwheat is fairly succulent at that stage of the game. And so that was my reaction that they could go ahead and plant right away.
And they could probably, if you wanted a short season crop, if you're not going to be planting your garlic for another month and a half or something, it might be too late to plant buckwheat. But it's really only about 30 days. I had some buckwheat this year that grew 4 feet tall. It was just
buckwheat's kind of amazing as a summer crop. It is. Yeah. It's a very useful thing. Where do you buy your buckwheat? What sources do you usually have?
Well, I've been growing it for so long that
just save your own?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or it seeds itself.
It seeds itself.
Yeah, and that's...
that's a mixed blessing, isn't it?
That's right. I was glad to hear you say that they tilled it in before the
seeds were formed.
Right, because, boy, they'll form a lot of them. But.
Right. And a lot of people will mistake an emerging buckwheat seedling for morning glory because they look very, very similar.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Yeah, that's...
They're rather broad-leafed, kind of angular, if I remember correctly.
They are, right.
But a nice-looking seedling.
Yes, yes. Too.
Okay, I think we have time for one last call. Sean, good morning. You're with the Dirtbag.
Good morning, you guys. Well, just a minor thing compared to what you were talking a moment ago about Bannon and Brookings. Part of the reason, I think, for Brookings and the bulbs is because, of course, it sits in it's the one area that's a banana belt right in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes a big difference in terms of their growing the bulbs, even though I think you said they grow mostly in greenhouses.
I'm sorry?
Did you say that they grew most of the bulbs in greenhouses?
No.
No.
Oh, okay.
They're sent to be forced in the greenhouses, but they're grown outdoors in Brookings and Del Norte.
Right, and that's what I thought. So I think a lot of the climate has to do with that. And ironically, you were saying most of the bulbs, of course, are shipped to the east and so forth. And it's the same thing. I was just going to tie it into cranberries is that even though Oregon grows a good majority of the cranberries in the country, they actually 90% of our crop, I think, gets shipped to the east.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. So
for that nice red color, as far as if my memory serves me correct.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember the grower. There's a grower actually between Bandon and Port Orford. There's a great grower there, Organic Berries. I can't remember his name, but you can pick his berries up at New Seasons Market.
Oh, that's good.
Order them online.
Well, another local source for cranberries.
That's right.
It's not really within 100 miles, but it's better than Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, thanks a lot.
You bet. Thanks for the call.